The croquet party to which the Princess Ruskaya had invited Anna was to consist of two ladies and their adorers. These two ladies were the chief representatives of a select new Peterburg circle, nicknamed, in imitation of some imitation, Les Sept Merveilles du Monde. These ladies belonged to a circle which, though of the highest society, was utterly hostile to that in which Anna moved. Moreover, old Stremov, one of the most influential people in Peterburg, and the admirer of Lisa Merkelova, was Alexei Alexandrovich's enemy in the political world. From all these considerations, Anna had not meant to go, and the hints in Princess Ruskaya's note referred to her refusal. But now Anna was eager to go in the hope of seeing Vronsky. Anna arrived at Princess Ruskaya's earlier than the other guests. At the very moment of her entry, Vronsky's footman, with his side whiskers combed out and looking like a camera junker, went in too. He stopped at the door and, taking off his cap, let her pass. Anna recognized him and only then recalled that Vronsky had told her the day before that he would not come. Most likely he was sending a note to say so. As she took off her outer garment in the hall, she heard the footman say, rolling his R's, even like a camera junker, from the count for the princess as he handed over the note. She longed to question him as to where his master was. She longed to turn back and send him a letter to come and see her, or to go herself to see him. But none of the three courses was possible. Already she heard bells ringing ahead of her to announce her arrival, and Princess Ruskaya's footman was standing at the open door, waiting for her to pass into the inner rooms. The princess is in the garden. She will be informed immediately. Would you be pleased to walk into the garden? Announced another footman in another room. The position of uncertainty, of indecision, was still the same as at home, worse, in fact, since it was impossible to take any step, impossible to see Vronsky, and she had to remain here among outsiders, in company so uncongenial to her present mood. But she was wearing a dress that she knew suited her. She was not alone. All around was that luxurious setting of idleness that she was used to, and she felt less wretched than at home. She was not forced to think what she had to do. Everything would be done of itself. On meeting Betsy coming toward her in a white gown that struck her by its elegance, Anna smiled to her just as she always did. Princess Ruskaya was walking with Tushkevich and a young lady, a relation, who, to the great joy of her parents in the provinces, was spending the summer with the fashionable princess. There was probably something unusual about Anna, for Betsy noticed it at once. I slept badly, answered Anna, looking intently at the footman who came to meet them, and, as she supposed, brought Vronsky's note. How glad I am you've come, said Betsy. I'm tired and was just longing to have some tea before they come. You might go, she turned to Tushkevich, with Masha, and try the croquet grounds over there, where they've been clipping it. We shall have time to talk a little over tea. We'll have a cozy chat, eh? She said in English to Anna, with a smile, pressing the hand which held a parasol. Yes, especially as I can't stay very long with you. I'm forced to go on to Madame Breed. I've been promising to go for a century, said Anna, to whom lying, alien as it was to her nature, had become not merely simple and natural in society, but a positive source of satisfaction. Why she said this, why she had not thought of a second before, she could not have explained. She had said it simply from the reflection that as Vronsky would not be here, she had better secure her own freedom and try to see him somehow. But why she had spoken of old Hoffreilin Breed, whom she had to go and see, as she had to see many other people, she could not have explained. And yet, as it turned out, had she cudgeled her brains for the most cunning subterfuge to meet Vronsky, she could have thought of nothing better. No, I'm not going to let you go for anything, answered Betsy, looking intently into Anna's face. Really, if I were not fond of you, I should feel offended. One would think you were afraid my society would compromise you. Tea in the small dining room, please, she said, half closing her eyes, as she always did when addressing the footman. Taking the note from him, she read it. Alexei is playing us false, she said in French. He writes that he can't come. She added in a tone as simple and natural as though it could never enter her head that Vronsky could mean anything more to Anna than a game of croquet. Anna knew that Betsy knew everything, but hearing how she spoke of Vronsky before her, she almost felt persuaded for a minute that she knew nothing. Ah, said Anna indifferently, as though not greatly interested in the matter, and she went on, smiling. How can you or your friends compromise anyone? This playing with words, this hiding of a secret, had a great fascination for Anna, as indeed it has for all women. And it was not the necessity of concealment, not the purpose for which the concealment was contrived, but the process of concealment itself which attracted her. I can't be more Catholic than the Pope, she said. Stremov and Liza Merkalova, why, they're the cream of society. Besides, they're received everywhere. And I, she laid special stress on the I, have never been strict and intolerant. It's simply that I haven't the time. No, you don't care, perhaps, to meet Stremov. Let him and Alexei Alexandrovich tilt at each other in the committee. That's no affair of ours, but in society he's the most amiable man I know, and an ardent croquet player. You shall see. And in spite of his absurd position as Lisa's lovesick swain at his age, you ought to see how he carries off the absurd position. He's very nice. Don't you know Sappho Stolz? Oh, that's a new type. Quite new. Betsy went on with all this chatter, yet at the same time, from her good-humored, shrewd glance, Anna felt that she partly guessed her plight and was hatching something for her benefit. They were in the little boudoir. I must write to Alexei, though, and Betsy sat down to the table, scribbled a few lines, and put the note in an envelope. I'm telling him to come to dinner. I've one lady extra to dinner with me and no man to take her in. Look what I've said. Will that persuade him? Excuse me, I must leave you for a minute. Would you seal it up, please, and send it off, she said from the door. I have to give some directions. Without a moment's hesitation, Anna sat down to the table with Betsy's letter, and without reading it, wrote below, It's essential for me to see you. Come to the Breed Garden. I shall be there at 6 o'clock. She sealed it up, and Betsy, coming back in her presence, handed the note for transmittal. At tea, which was brought them on a little tea table in the cool little drawing room, a cozy chat promised by Princess Tverskaya before the arrival of her visitors really did come off between the two women. They criticized the people they were expecting, and the conversation fell upon Liza Merkalova. She's very sweet, and I always liked her, said Anna. You ought to like her. She raves about you. Yesterday she came up to me after the races and was in despair at not finding you. She says you're a real heroine of romance, and that if she were a man, she would do all sorts of mad things for your sake. Stremov says she does that as it is. But do tell me, please. I never could make it out, said Anna, after being silent for some time, speaking in a tone that showed she was not asking an idle question, but that what she was asking was of greater importance to her than it should have been. Do tell me, please, what are her relations with Prince Kalushki? Mishka, as he's called. I've met them so little. What does it mean? Betsy smiled with her eyes and looked intently at Anna. It's a new mode, she said. They've all adopted that mode. They've flung their caps over the windmills, but there are ways and ways of flinging them. Yes, but precisely what are her relations with Kalushki? Betsy broke into unexpectedly mirthful and irrepressible laughter, a thing which rarely happened with her. You're encroaching on Princess Meigskaya's special domain now. That's the question of an infant terrible. And Betsy obviously tried to restrain herself, but could not, and went off into peals of that infectious laughter peculiar to people who do not laugh often. You'd better ask them, she brought out between tears of laughter. No, you laugh, said Anna, laughing too in spite of herself, but I never could understand it. I can't understand the husband's role in it. The husband? Liza Merkalova's husband carries her shawl and is always ready to be of use, but no one cares to inquire about what is really going on. You know, in decent society, one doesn't talk or think even of certain details of the toilet. That's how it is in this case. Will you be at Madame Roland Dackey's bet? Asked Anna, to change the conversation. I don't think so, answered Betsy, and without looking at her friend, she began filling the little transparent cups with fragrant tea. Putting a cup before Anna, she took out a thin cigarette, and fitting it into a silver holder, she lighted it. It's like this, you see. I'm in a fortunate position, she began, quite serious now as she took up her cup. I understand you, and I understand Lisa. Lisa is now one of those naive natures that, like children, don't know what's good and what's bad. Anyway, she didn't comprehend it when she was very young. And now she's aware that the lack of comprehension suits her. Now, perhaps, she doesn't know on purpose, said Betsy with a subtle smile. But anyway, it suits her. The very same thing, don't you see? May be looked at tragically and turned into misery. Or it may be looked at simply and even humorously. Possibly you are inclined to look at things too tragically. How I should like to know other people just as I know myself, said Anna seriously and dreamily. Am I worse than other people or better? I think I'm worse. Infant terrible, repeated Betsy. But here they are. Chapter 18. They heard the sound of steps and a man's voice, then a woman's voice and laughter, and immediately after there walked in the expected guests. Sappho Stoltz, and a young man beaming with excess of health, the so-called Vaska. It was evident that ample supplies of beefsteak, truffles, and burgundy were profitable for his health. Vaska bowed to the two ladies and glanced at them, but only for 1 second. He walked after Sappho into the drawing room and followed her about as though he were chained to her, keeping his sparkling eyes fixed on her as though he wanted to eat her. Sappho Stoltz was a blonde beauty with black eyes. She walked with smart little steps in high-heeled shoes and shook hands with the ladies vigorously like a man. Anna had never met this new star of fashion and was struck by her beauty, the exaggerated extreme to which her dress was carried and the boldness of her manners. On her head there was such an échafaudage of soft golden hair, her own and false mix, that her head was equal in size to the elegantly rounded bust of which so much was exposed in front. The impulsiveness, abruptness of her movements was such that at every step the lines of her knees and the upper part of her legs were distinctly marked under her dress, and the question involuntarily rose in one's mind, where in the undulating, piled-up mountain of material at the back, the real body of the woman, so small and slender, so naked in front, and so hidden behind and below, really came to an end. Betsy made haste to introduce her to Anna. Only fancy, we all but ran over 2 soldiers, she began telling them at once, using her eyes, smiling and twitching away her train, which she at first threw too much to one side. I drove here with Vaska. Ah, to be sure, you don't know each other. And mentioning his surname, she introduced the young man, and reddening, broke into a ringing laugh at her mistake, that is, at her having called him Vaska before a stranger. Vaska bowed once more to Anna, but he said nothing to her. He addressed Sappho. You've lost your bet. We got here first. Pay up, said he, smiling. Sappho laughed still more festively. Not just now, said she. It's all one. I'll have it later. Very well, very well. Oh, yes, she turned suddenly to Princess Betsy. I am a nice person. I positively forgot it. I've brought you a visitor, and here he comes. The unexpected young visitor whom Sappho had brought with her and whom she had forgotten was, however, a personage of such consequence that, in spite of his youth, both the ladies rose on his entrance. He was a new admirer of Sappho's. Like Vaska, he now dogged her footsteps. Soon after Prince Kulishki arrived, and Lisa Merkalova with Stremov, Lisa Merkalova was a thin brunette with an oriental, languid type of face and charming, as everyone used to say, ineffable eyes. The tone of her dark dress, Anna immediately observed and appreciated the fact, was in perfect harmony with her style of beauty. Lisa was as soft and loose as Sappho was tight and shackled. But to Anna's taste, Lisa was far more attractive. Betsy had said to Anna that she had adopted the pose of an unsophisticated child, but when Anna saw her, she felt this was not the truth. She really was unsophisticated, spoiled, yet a sweet and irresponsible woman. It is true that her tone was the same as Sappho's, that like Sappho, she had two men, one young and one old, tacked onto her and devouring her with their eyes. But there was something in her higher than her surroundings. There was in her the glow of the real diamond among paste. This glow shone out in her charming, truly ineffable eyes. The weary and at the same time passionate glance of those eyes, encircled by dark rings, impressed one by its perfect sincerity. Everyone looking into those eyes fancied he knew her wholly, and knowing her, could not but love her. At the sight of Anna, her whole face lighted up at once with a smile of delight. "Ah, how glad I am to see you," she said, going up to her. "Yesterday at the races I wanted just to get to you, but you'd gone away. I did so want to see you, especially yesterday." "Wasn't it awful?" she said, looking at Anna with eyes that seemed to lay bare all her soul. "Yes, I had no idea it would be so thrilling," said Anna, blushing. The company got up at this moment to go into the garden. "I'm not going," said Lisa, smiling and settling herself close to Anna. "You won't go either, will you? Who wants to play croquet?" "Oh, I like it," said Anna. "There, how do you manage never to be bored by things? One has but to look at you to be joyful. You're alive, but I'm bored." "How can you be bored? Why, you live among the merriest people in Petersburg," said Anna. "Possibly the people who are not of our set are even more bored, but we are not amused ourselves. I certainly am not, but awfully, awfully bored." Sappho, smoking a cigarette, went off into the garden with the two young men. Betsy and Stremov remained at the tea table. "You bored?" said Betsy. "Sappho says they enjoyed themselves tremendously at your house last night." "Ah, how dreary it all was," said Lisa Merkalova. "We all drove back to my place after the races, and always the same people, always the same thing. We lounged about on sofas all the evening. What's enjoyable about that?" "No, do tell me how you manage never to be bored," she said, addressing Anna again. "One has but to look at you, and one sees a woman who may be happy or unhappy, but who isn't bored. Tell me, how do you do it?" "I do nothing," answered Anna, blushing at these searching questions. "That's the best way," Stremov put in. Stremov was a man of 50, partly gray, but still vigorous in his appearance, very ugly, but with a characteristic and intelligent face. Lisa Merkalova was his wife's niece, and he spent all his leisure hours with her. On meeting Anna Karenina, since he was Alexei Alexandrovich's enemy in the government, he tried, like a shrewd man and a man of the world, to be particularly cordial with her, the wife of his enemy. "Nothing," he put in with a subtle smile, "that's the very best way. I told you long ago," he said, turning to Lisa Merkalova, "that in order not to be bored, you mustn't think you're going to be bored. Just as you mustn't be afraid of not being able to fall asleep if you're afraid of sleeplessness. That's precisely what Anna Arkadyevna has just said." "I should be very glad if I had said it, for it's not only clever but true," said Anna, smiling. "No, do tell me why it is one can't go to sleep and one can't help being bored. To sleep well, one should work, and to enjoy oneself, one should also work. What am I to work for when my work is of no use to anybody, and I can't and won't knowingly make a pretense at it?" "You're incorrigible," said Stremov without looking at her, and he spoke again to Anna. As he rarely met Anna, he could say nothing but banalities to her. But he said those banalities, when was she returning to Petersburg, and how fond Countess Lydia Ivanova was of her, with an expression which suggested that he longed with his whole soul to please her and show his regard for her, and even more than that. Tushkevich came in announcing that the party were awaiting the other players to begin croquet. "No, don't go away. Please don't," pleaded Lisa Merkalova, hearing that Anna was going. Stremov joined in her entreaties. "It's too violent a transition," he said, "to go from such company to old Madame Vrieve. And besides, you will only give her a chance for talking scandal, while here you will arouse other feelings of the finest and directly opposed to scandal," he said to her. Anna pondered for an instant in uncertainty. This shrewd man's flattering words, the naive, childlike affection shown her by Lisa Merkalova, and all the worldly atmosphere she was used to, it was all so easy, while that which was in store for her was so difficult, that she was, for a minute, in uncertainty. Should she remain? Should she put it off a little longer, the painful moment of explanation? But remembering what was in store for her when she would be alone at home, if she did not come to some decision, remembering that gesture, terrible even in memory, when she had clutched her hair in both hands, she said goodbye and went away. Chapter 19. In spite of Vronsky's apparently frivolous life in society, he was a man who hated disorder. In early youth, in the core of pages, he had experienced the humiliation of a refusal when he had tried, being in difficulties, to borrow money, and since then he had never once put himself in the same position again. In order to keep his affairs in some sort of order, he was wont, about 5 times a year, more or less frequently according to circumstances, to shut himself up alone and put all his affairs into definite shape. This he would call his day of washing up, or faire la lessive. On waking up late in the morning after the races, Vronsky put on a white linen coat, and without shaving or taking his bath, he distributed about the table money, bills, and letters, and set to work. Petritsky, who knew he was ill-tempered on such occasions, on waking up and seeing his comrade at the writing table, quietly dressed and went out without getting in his way. Every man who knows to the minutest details all the complexity of the conditions surrounding him cannot help imagining that the complexity of these conditions and the difficulty of making them clear is something exceptional and personal, peculiar to himself, and never supposes that others are surrounded by just as complicated an array of personal affairs as he is. So indeed it seemed to Vronsky. And not without inward pride and not without reason, he thought that any other man would long ago have been in difficulties and would have been forced to some dishonorable course if he had found himself in such a difficult position. But Vronsky felt that now especially it was essential for him to clear up and define his position if he were to avoid getting into difficulties. What Vronsky attacked first as being the easiest was his pecuniary position. Writing out on note paper in his minute handwriting all that he owed, he added up the amount and found that his debts amounted to 17,000 and some odd hundreds, which he left out for the sake of clearness. Reckoning up his cash and the balance in his bank book, he found that he had left 1,800 rubles and nothing coming in before the new year. Reckoning over again his list of debts, Vronsky copied it, dividing it into 3 classes. In the first class, he put the debts which he would have to pay at once, or for which he must in any case have the money ready so that on demand for payment there would not be a moment's delay in paying. Such debts amounted to about 4,000, 1,500 for a horse and 2,500 as surety for a young comrade, Vanevsky, who had lost that sum to a card sharper in Vronsky's presence. Vronsky had wanted to pay the money at the time. He had that amount then. But Vanevsky and Yashvin had insisted that they would pay and not Vronsky, who had not played. So far, so good. But Vronsky knew that in this dirty business, though his only share in it was undertaken by word of mouth to be surety for Vanevsky, it was absolutely necessary for him to have the 2,500 rubles so as to be able to fling it at the chief and have no more words with him. And so, for this first and most important division, he must have 4,000 rubles. The second class, 8,000 rubles, consisted of less important debts. These were principally accounts owing in connection with his racehorses, to the purveyor of oats and hay, the Englishman, the saddler, and so on. He would have to pay some 2,000 rubles on these debts, too, in order to be quite free from anxiety. The last class of debts, to shops, to hotels, to his tailor, were such as need not be considered, so that he needed at least 6,000 rubles, and he only had 1,800 for current expenses. For a man with 100,000 rubles of revenue, which was what everyone fixed as Vronsky's income, such debts, one would suppose, could hardly be embarrassing. but the fact was that he was far from having 100,000. His father's immense property, which alone yielded a yearly income of 200,000, was left undivided between the brothers. At the time when the elder brother, with a mass of debts, had married Princess Maria Shirkova, the daughter of a Decabrist, without any fortune whatever, Alexei had given up to his elder brother almost the whole income from his father's estate, reserving for himself only 25,000 a year from it. Alexei had said at the time to his brother that the sum would be sufficient for him until he married, which he would probably never do. And his brother, who was in command of one of the most expensive regiments and was only just married, could not decline the gift. His mother, who had her own separate property, had allowed Alexei every year 20,000 in addition to the 25,000 he had reserved, and Alexei had spent it all. Of late, his mother, incensed with him on account of his love affair and his leaving Moscow, had given up sending the money. And in consequence of this, Vronsky, who had been in the habit of living on the scale of 45,000 a year, having only received 20,000 that year, now found himself in difficulties. To get out of these difficulties, he could not apply to his mother for money. Her last letter, which he had received the day before, had particularly exasperated him by the hints it contained that she was quite ready to help him to succeed in the world and in the army, but not to lead a life which scandalized all good society. His mother's attempt to buy him stung him to the quick and made him feel colder than ever toward her, but he could not draw back from the generous word when it was once uttered, even though he felt now vaguely foreseeing certain eventualities in his liaison with Madame Karenina, that his generous word had been spoken thoughtlessly, and that, even though he were not married, he might need all the 100,000 of income. But it was impossible to draw back. He had only to recall his brother's wife, to remember how that sweet, delightful Varya sought, at every convenient opportunity, to remind him that she remembered his generosity and appreciated it, to grasp the impossibility of taking back his gift. It was as impossible as beating a woman, or stealing, or lying. One thing only could and ought to be done, and Vronsky determined upon it without an instant's hesitation. To borrow money from a moneylender, 10,000 rubles, a proceeding which presented no difficulty. To cut down his expenses generally, and to sell his racehorses. Resolving on this, he promptly wrote a note to Roland Daki, who had more than once sent to him with offers to buy horses from him. Then he sent for the Englishman and the moneylender and divided what money he had according to the accounts he intended to pay. Having finished this business, he wrote a cold and cutting answer to his mother. Then he took out of his notebook 3 notes of Anna's, read them again, burned them, and remembering their conversation on the previous day, he sank into deep thought. Chapter 20. Vronsky's life was particularly happy in that he had a code of principles which defined with unfailing certitude what he ought and what he ought not to do. This code of principles covered only a very small circle of contingencies, but then the principles were never doubtful, and Vronsky, as he never went outside that circle, had never had a moment's hesitation about doing what he ought to do. These principles laid down as invariable rules, but one must pay a card sharper, but need not pay a tailor, that one must never tell a lie to a man, but one may to a woman, that one must never cheat anyone, but one may a husband, that one must never pardon an insult, but one may give one, and so on. These principles were possibly not reasonable and not good, but they were of unfailing certainty, and so long as he adhered to them, Vronsky felt that his heart was at peace and he could hold his head up. But of late, in regard to his relations with Anna, Vronsky had begun to feel that this code of principles did not fully cover all possible contingencies, and to foresee in the future difficulties and perplexities for which he could find no guiding clue. His present relation to Anna and to her husband was, to his mind, clear and simple. It was clearly and precisely defined in the code of principles by which he was guided. She was an honorable woman who had bestowed her love upon him, and he loved her, and therefore she was in his eyes a woman who had a right to the same respect, or even more, than a lawful wife. He would have had his hand chopped off before he would have allowed himself a word by a hint to humiliate her, or even to fall short of the fullest respect a woman could look for. His attitude toward society, too, was clear. Everyone might know, might suspect it, but no one might dare to speak of it. If any did speak, he was ready to force all who might do so to be silent and to respect the non-existent honor of the woman he loved. His attitude to the husband was the clearest of all. From the moment that Anna loved Vronsky, he had regarded his own right over her as the one thing unassailable. Her husband was simply a superfluous and tiresome person. No doubt he was in a pitiable position, but how could that be helped? The one thing the husband had a right to was to demand satisfaction with a weapon in his hand, and Vronsky was prepared for this at any minute. But of late, new inner relations had arisen between her and him, which frightened Vronsky by their indefiniteness. Only the day before she had told him that she was with child, and he felt that this fact, and what she expected of him, called for something not fully defined in that code of principles by which he had hitherto steered his course in life. And he had been indeed caught unawares, and at the first moment when she spoke to him of her position, his heart had prompted him to beg her to leave her husband. He had said that, but now, thinking things over, he saw clearly that it would be better to manage avoiding that. And at the same time, as he told himself this, he was afraid whether such an avoidance were not wrong. If I told her to leave her husband, it would mean uniting her life with mine. Am I prepared for that? How can I take her away now when I have no money? Supposing I could arrange, but how can I take her away while I'm in the service? If I say it, I ought to be prepared to do it. That is, I ought to have the money and to retire from the army. And he grew thoughtful. The question whether to retire from the service or not brought him to the other, and perhaps the chief, though hidden, interest of his life, of which none knew but he. Ambition was the old dream of his youth and childhood, a dream which he did not confess even to himself, though it was so strong that now this passion was even doing battle with his love. His first steps in the world and in the service had been successful, but 2 years before he had made a great mistake. Anxious to show his independence and for the sake of advancement, he had refused a post that had been offered him, hoping that this refusal would heighten his value. But it turned out that he had been too bold and he was passed over. And having, whether he liked it or not, taken up for himself the position of an independent man, he carried it off with great tact and good sense, behaving as though he bore no grudge against anyone, nor regarding himself as injured in any way and caring for nothing but to be left alone, since he was enjoying himself. In reality, he had ceased to enjoy himself as long ago as the year before, when he had gone to Moscow. He felt that this independent attitude of a man who might have done anything but cared to do nothing was already beginning to pall, that many people were beginning to fancy that he was not really capable of anything but being a straightforward, good-natured fellow. His connection with Madame Karenina, by creating so much sensation and attracting general attention, had given him a fresh distinction, which had soothed his gnawing worm of ambition for a while. But a week ago that worm had been roused up again with fresh force. The friend of his childhood, a man of the same set, of the same coterie, his comrade in the corps of pages, Serpukhovskoy, who had left school with him and had been his rival in class and gymnastics in their scrapes and their dreams of glory, had come back a few days before from Central Asia, where he had gained two steps up in rank and an order rarely bestowed upon generals so young. As soon as he arrived in Petersburg, people began to talk about him as a newly risen star of the first magnitude. A schoolfellow of Vronsky's and of the same age, he was a general and was expecting a command which might have influence on the course of political events. While Vronsky, though he was independent and brilliant and beloved by a charming woman, was simply a cavalry captain who was readily allowed to be as independent as ever he liked. Of course, I don't envy Serpukhovskoy and never could envy him, but his advancement shows me that one has only to watch one's opportunity and the career of a man like me may be very rapidly made. 3 years ago, he was in just the same position as I am. If I retire, I burn my ships. If I remain in the Army, I lose nothing. She said herself she did not wish to change her position, and with her love, I cannot feel envious of Serpukhovskoy. And slowly twirling his mustaches, he got up from the table and walked about the room. His eyes shone particularly brightly, and he felt in that firm, calm, and happy frame of mind which always came after he had thoroughly faced his position. Everything was straight and clear, just as after former days of striking balances. He shaved, took a cold bath, dressed, and went out. Chapter 21. I've come to fetch you. Your lessive lasted a good time today, said Petrovsky. Well, is it over? It's over, answered Vronsky, smiling with his eyes only and twirling the tips of his mustaches as circumspectly as though after the perfect order into which his affairs had been brought, any overbold or rapid movement might disturb it. You're always just as if you'd come out of a bath after it, said Petrovsky. I've come from Britska. That was what they called the colonel. You're expected there. Vronsky, without answering, looked at his comrade, thinking of something else. Yes. Is that music at his place? He said, listening to the familiar brass sounds of trumpets, of polkas and waltzes floating across to him. What's the fate? Serpukhovskoy's come. Aha, said Vronsky. Why, I didn't know. The smile in his eyes gleamed more brightly than ever. Having once made up his mind that he was happy in his love, that he sacrificed his ambition to it, at any rate having taken up this role, Vronsky was incapable of feeling either envious of Serpukhovskoy or vexed at him for not having come to him first upon coming to the regiment. Serpukhovskoy was a good friend, and he was delighted he had come. Ah, I'm very glad. The colonel, Demon, had taken a large country house. The whole party was on the wide lower balcony. In the courtyard, the first objects that met Vronsky's eyes were a band of singers in short white linen jackets, standing near a barrel of vodka, and the robust, good-humored figure of the colonel surrounded by officers. He had gone out as far as the first step of the balcony and was loudly shouting to drown out the band, playing an Offenbach quadrille, waving his arms and giving some orders to a few soldiers standing on one side. A group of soldiers, a quartermaster, and several subalterns came up to the balcony with Vronsky. The colonel returned to the table, went out again on the steps with a tumbler in his hand, and proposed the toast. To the health of our former comrade, the gallant general, Prince Serpukhovskoy. Hurrah! The colonel was followed by Serpukhovskoy, who came out on the steps smiling with a glass in his hand. You always get younger, Bondarenko, he said to the rosy-cheeked, smart-looking sergeant standing just before him, still youngish-looking, though doing his second term of service. It was 3 years since Vronsky had seen Serpukhovskoy. He looked more robust, had let his whiskers grow, but was still the same graceful creature, whose face and figure were even more striking from their fineness and nobility than their beauty. The only change Vronsky detected in him was that subdued, continual beaming which settles on the faces of men who are successful and are sure of the recognition of their success by everyone. He observed it in Serpukhovskoy. As Serpukhovskoy came down the steps, he saw Vronsky. A smile of pleasure lighted up his face. He tossed his head upward and waved the glass in his hand, greeting Vronsky, and showing him by the gesture that he could not come to him before kissing the sergeant, who stood craning forward, his lips ready to be kissed. Here he is, shouted the colonel. Ayashvin told me you were in one of your gloomy tempers. Serpukhovskoy kissed the moist, fresh lips of the brave sergeant, and wiping his mouth with his handkerchief, walked up to Vronsky. How glad I am, he said, squeezing his hand and drawing him to one side. You look after him, the colonel shouted to Ayashvin, pointing to Vronsky, and he went down below to the soldiers. Why weren't you at the races yesterday? I expected to see you there, said Vronsky, scrutinizing Serpukhovskoy. I did go, but late. I beg your pardon, he added, and turned to the adjutant, Please have this distributed from me, each man as much as it comes to. And he hurriedly took 3 notes for 100 rubles each from his pocketbook and blushed. Vronsky, have a bite or a drink? Asked Yashvin. Aye, something for the Count to eat? There, drink that. The spree at the Colonel's lasted a long while. There was a great deal of drinking. They swung Serpukhovskoy and tossed him in the air. Then they did the same to the Colonel. Then, to the accompaniment of the band, the Colonel himself danced with Petritsky. Then the Colonel, who began to show signs of weakening, sat down on a bench in the courtyard and began demonstrating to Yashvin the superiority of Russia over Prussia, especially in cavalry attack. And there was a lull in the revelry for a moment. Serpukhovskoy went into the house to the bathroom to wash his hands and found Vronsky there. Vronsky was sousing his head with water. He had taken off his coat and put his red, hairy neck under the tap and was rubbing it in his head with his hands. When he had finished, Vronsky sat down by Serpukhovskoy. They both sat down in the bathroom on a lounge, and a conversation began which was very interesting to both of them. I've always been hearing about you through my wife, said Serpukhovskoy. I'm glad you've been seeing her pretty often. She's friendly with Varia. And they're the only women in Petersburg I care about seeing, answered Vronsky, smiling. He smiled because he foresaw the topic the conversation would turn to, and he was glad of it. The only ones? Serpukhovskoy queried, smiling. Yes, and I heard news of you, but not only through your wife, said Vronsky, checking Serpukhovskoy's hint by assuming a stern expression. I was greatly delighted to hear of your success, but not a bit surprised. I expected even more. Serpukhovskoy smiled. Such an opinion of him was obviously agreeable to him, and he did not think it necessary to conceal it. Well, I, on the contrary, expected less, I'll own up frankly. But I'm glad, very glad. I'm ambitious. That's my weakness, and I confess to it. Perhaps you wouldn't confess to it if you hadn't been successful, said Vronsky. I don't suppose so, said Serpukhovskoy, smiling again. I won't say life wouldn't be worth living without it, but it would be dull. Of course, I may be mistaken, but I fancy I have a certain capacity for the line I've chosen, and that if there is to be power of any sort in my hands, it will be better than in the hands of a good many people. I know, said Serpukhovskoy, with beaming consciousness of success, and so the nearer I get to it, the better pleased I am. Perhaps that is true for you, but not for everyone. I used to think so, too. But now I see and think life worth living, not only for that. There it comes, said Serpukhovskoy, laughing. Ever since I heard about you, about your refusal, I began. Of course I approved of what you did, but there are ways of doing everything, and I think your action was good in itself, but you didn't do it in quite the way you should have done. What's done can't be undone, and you know I never go back on what I've done, and besides, I'm very well off. Very well off, for the time, but you're not satisfied with that. And I wouldn't say this to your brother. He's a charming child, like our host here. Here he goes, he added, listening to the roar of hurrah, and he's happy. That does not satisfy you? I didn't say it did. Yes, but that's not the only thing. Such men as you are wanted. By whom? By whom? By society. By Russia. Russia needs men. She needs a party, or else everything goes and will go to the dogs. How do you mean? Burdenev's party against the Russian communists? No, said Serpukhovskoy, frowning with vexation at being suspected of such an absurdity. Tout ca est un black. That has always been and always will be. There are no communists. But intriguing people have to invent a noxious, dangerous party. It's an old trick. No, what's wanted is a powerful party of independent men like you and me. But why so? Vronsky mentioned a few men who were in power. Why aren't they independent men? Simply because they have not, or have not had from birth, an independent fortune. They've not had a name. They weren't born close to the sun as we were. They can be bought either by money or by favor. And they have to find a support for themselves in inventing a trend. And they bring forward some notion, some trend that they don't believe in. That does harm. And the whole policy is really only a means to a house at the expense of the crown and so much income. Cela n'est pas plus fin que ça. When you get a peep at their cards, I may be inferior to them, more stupid perhaps, though I don't see why I should be inferior to them. But you and I have one important, certain advantage over them in being more difficult to buy, and such men are more needed than ever. Vronsky listened attentively, but he was not so much interested by the meaning of the words as by the attitude of Serpukhovskoy, who was already contemplating a struggle with the existing powers and already had his likes and dislikes in that world, while his own interest in his service did not go beyond the interests of his squadron. Vronsky felt, too, how powerful Serpukhovskoy might become through his unmistakable faculty of thinking things out and for taking things in, through his intelligence and gift of eloquence so rarely met with in the world in which he moved. And ashamed as he was of the feeling, he felt envious. "Still, I haven't the one thing of paramount importance for that," he answered. "I haven't the desire for power. I had it once, but it's gone." "Excuse me? That's not true," said Serpukhovskoy, smiling. "Yes, it's true, it's true. Now to be truthful," Vronsky added. "Yes, it's true now, that's another thing, but that now won't last forever." "Perhaps," answered Vronsky. "You say perhaps," Serpukhovskoy went on, as though guessing his thoughts, "but I say for certain. And that's what I wanted to see you for. Your action was just what it should have been. I see that, but you ought not to persevere in it. I only ask you to give me carte blanche. I am not going to offer you my protection. Though, indeed, why shouldn't I protect you? You've protected me often enough. I should hope our friendship rises above all that sort of thing." "Yes," he said, smiling to him as tenderly as a woman, "give me carte blanche, retire from regiment, and I'll get you in imperceptibly." "But you must understand that I want nothing," said Vronsky, "except to leave things just as they were." Serpukhovskoy got up and stood facing him. "You said, leave things just as they were. I understand what that means, but listen. We're the same age. You've known a greater number of women, perhaps, than I have." Serpukhovskoy's smile and gestures told Vronsky that he mustn't be afraid, that he would be tender and careful in touching the sore place. "But I'm married, and believe me, in getting to know one's wife thoroughly, if one loves her, as someone has said, one gets to know all women better than if one knew thousands of them." "We're coming directly," Vronsky shouted to an officer who looked into the room and called them to the colonel. Vronsky was longing now to hear Serpukhovskoy to the end and know what he would say to him. "And here's my opinion for you. Women are the chief stumbling block in a man's career. It's hard to love a woman and do anything. There's only one way of having love conveniently without it being a hindrance. That's marriage. Now, how am I to tell you what I mean?" said Serpukhovskoy, who liked similes. Wait a minute. "Yes, just as you can only carry a fardeau, yet do something with your hands, when the fardeau is tied on your back, and that's marriage. And that's what I felt when I was married. My hands were suddenly set free. But if you drag that fardeau about with you without marriage, your hands will always be so full that you can do nothing. Look at Mazankov, at Krupov. They've ruined their careers for the sake of women." "What women?" said Vronsky, recalling the French woman and the actress with whom the two men he had mentioned were connected. "The firmer the woman's footing in society, the worse it is. That's much the same as not merely carrying the fardeau in your arms, but tearing it away from someone else." "You have never loved," Vronsky said softly, looking straight before him and thinking of Anna. "Perhaps, but you remember what I've said to you. And another thing, women are all more materialistic than men. We make something immense out of love, but they are always tear a tear." "Directly, directly," he called to the footman who came in, but the footman had not come to call him again as he supposed. The footman brought Vronsky a note. "A man brought it from Princess Verskaya." Vronsky opened the letter and flushed crimson. "My head's begun to ache. I'm going home," he said to Serpukhovskoy. "Oh, goodbye then. You give me carte blanche." We'll talk about it later on. I'll look you up in Petersburg. Chapter 22. It was 6 o'clock already, and so in order to be there quickly and at the same time not to drive with his own horses, known to everyone, Vronsky got into Ayashvin's hackney coach and told the coachman to drive as quickly as possible. It was a roomy, old-fashioned coach with seats for four. He sat in one corner, stretched his legs out on the front seat, and sank into deep thought. A vague sense of the clearness to which his affairs had been brought, a vague recollection of the friendliness and flattery of Serpukhovskoy, who had considered him a man who was needed, and most of all, the anticipation of the meeting before him, all blended into a general joyous sense of life. This feeling was so strong that he could not help smiling. He dropped his legs, crossed one leg over the other knee, and taking it in his hand, felt the springy muscle of the calf where it had been grazed the day before by his fall, and leaning back, he drew several deep breaths. "I'm happy, very happy," he said to himself. He had often before had this sense of physical joy in his own body, but he had never felt so fond of himself, of his own body, as at that moment. He enjoyed the slight ache in his strong leg. He enjoyed the muscular sensation of movement in his chest as he breathed. The bright, cold August day, which had made Anna feel so hopeless, seemed to him keenly stimulating and refreshed his face and neck that still tingled from the cold water. The scent of brilliantine on his mustaches struck him as particularly pleasant in the fresh air. Everything he saw from the carriage window, everything in that cold, pure air, in the pale light of the sunset, was as fresh and gay and strong as he was himself. The roofs of the houses shining in the rays of the setting sun, the sharp outlines of fences and angles of buildings, the figures of passers-by and carriages that met him now and then, the motionless green of the trees and grass, the fields with evenly drawn furrows of potatoes, and the slanting shadows that fell from the houses, the trees and the bushes, and even from the rows of potatoes. Everything was bright like a pretty landscape freshly painted and varnished. "Get on, get on," he said to the driver, putting his head out of the window, and pulling a 3-ruble note out of his pocket, he handed it to the man as he looked around. The driver's hand fumbled with something at the lamp, the whip cracked, and the coach rolled rapidly along the smooth high road. "I want nothing, nothing but this happiness," he thought, staring at the bone button of the bell in the space between the windows, and picturing to himself Anna just as he had seen her last time. "And as I go on, I love her more and more. Here's the garden of the Vridi's Crown Villa. Whereabouts will she be? Where? How? Why did she fix on this place to meet me, and why does she write in Betsy's letter?" He thought now for the first time wondering at it, but there was now no time for wonder. He called to the driver to stop before reaching the avenue, and opening the door, jumped out of the carriage as it was moving and went up the avenue that led to the house. There was no one in the avenue, but looking round to the right, he caught sight of her. Her face was hidden by a veil, but he drank in with glad eyes the special movement in walking, peculiar to her alone. The slope of her shoulders and the setting of her head, and at once a sort of electric shock ran all over him. With fresh force he felt conscious of himself, from the springy movements of his legs to the movements of his lungs as he breathed, and something set his lips twitching. Joining him, she pressed his hand tightly. "You're not angry because I sent for you? I absolutely had to see you," she said, and the serious and set line of her lips, which he saw under the veil, transformed his mood at once. "I angry? But how have you come? Where?" "Never mind," she said, laying her hand on his arm. "Come along, I must talk to you." He saw that something had happened and that the interview would not be a joyous one. In her presence he had no will of his own. Without knowing the grounds of her distress, he already felt the same distress unconsciously passing over him. What is it? What?" he asked her, squeezing her hand with his elbow and trying to read her thoughts in her face. She walked on a few steps in silence, gathering up her courage, and then suddenly she stopped. "I did not tell you yesterday," she began, breathing quickly and painfully, "that coming home with Alexei Alexandrovich, I told him everything. Told him I could not be his wife, that, and told him everything." He heard her, unconsciously bending his whole figure down to her, as though hoping in this way to soften the hardness of her position for her. But directly she had said this, he suddenly drew himself up. and a proud and hard expression came over his face. "Yes, yes, that's better, 1,000 times better. I know how painful it was," he said. But she was not listening to his words. She was reading his thoughts from the expression of his face. She could not guess that that arose from the first idea that presented itself to Vronsky, that a duel was now inevitable. The idea of a duel had never crossed her mind, and so she put a different interpretation on this passing expression of hardness. When she got her husband's letter, she knew then at the bottom of her heart that everything would go on in the old way, that she would not have the strength of will to forego her position, to abandon her son, and to join her lover. The morning spent at Princess Verskaya's had confirmed her still more in this, but this interview was still of the utmost gravity for her. She hoped that this interview would transform her position and save her. If, on hearing this news, he were to say to her resolutely, passionately, without an instant's wavering, "Throw up everything and come with me," she would give up her son and go away with him. But this news had not produced on him the effect she had expected. He simply seemed resentful of some affront. "It was not in the least painful for me. It happened of itself," she said irritably. "And see," she pulled her husband's letter out of her glove. I understand," he interrupted her, taking the letter but not reading it and trying to soothe her. "The one thing I longed for, the one thing I prayed for, was to cut short this position, so as to devote my life to your happiness." "Why do you tell me that?" she said. "Do you suppose I can doubt it? If I doubted..." "Who's that coming?" said Vronsky suddenly, pointing to two ladies walking toward them. "Perhaps they know us," and he hurriedly turned off, drawing her after him into a side path. "Oh, I don't care," she said. Her lips were quivering, and he fancied that her eyes looked with strange fury at him from under her veil. "I tell you that's not the point. I can't doubt that. But see what he writes me. Read it." She stood still again. Again, just as at that first moment of hearing of her rupture with her husband, Vronsky, on reading the letter, was unconsciously carried away by the natural sensation aroused in him by his own relation to the injured husband. Now, while he held his letter in his hands, he could not help picturing the challenge which he would most likely find at home today or tomorrow, and the duel itself, in which, with the same cold and haughty expression that his face was assuming at this moment, he would await the injured husband's shot after having himself fired into the air. And at that instant there flashed across his mind the thought of what Serpukhovskoy had just said to him, and what he had himself been thinking in the morning, that it was better not to bind himself, and he knew that he could not tell her this thought. Having read the letter, he raised his eyes to her, and there was no firmness in them. She saw at once that he had been thinking about it before by himself. She knew that whatever he might say to her, he would not say all he thought, and she knew that her last hope had failed her. This was not what she had been looking for. "You see the sort of man he is," she said with a shaking voice. "He..." "Forgive me, but I rejoice at it," Vronsky interrupted. "For God's sake, let me finish," he added, his eyes imploring her to give him time to explain his words. "I rejoice because things cannot possibly remain as he supposes." "Why can't they?" Anna said, restraining her tears and obviously attaching no sort of consequence to what he said. She felt that her fate was sealed. Vronsky meant that after the duel, the inevitable, he thought, things could not go on as before, but he said something different. "It can't go on. I hope that now you will leave him. I hope," he was confused and reddened, "that you will let me arrange and plan our life." "Tomorrow," he was beginning. She did not let him go on. "But my child," she shrieked, "you see what he writes. I should have to leave him, and I can't and won't do that." "But for God's sake, which is better, to leave your child or keep up this degrading situation?" "To whom is it degrading?" "To all, and most of all, to you." "You say degrading? Don't say that. These words have no meaning for me," she said in a shaking voice. She did not want him now to say what was untrue. She had nothing left her but his love, and she wanted to love him. "Don't you understand that from the day I loved you, everything has changed for me? For me, there is one thing and one thing only, your love. If that's mine, I feel so exalted, so strong, that nothing can be degrading to me. I am proud of my position, because proud of being proud." She could not say what she was proud of. Tears of shame and despair choked her utterance. She stood still and sobbed. He felt, too, something swelling in his throat and twitching in his nose, and for the first time in his life he felt on the point of weeping. He could not have said exactly what it was had touched him so. He felt sorry for her, and he felt he could not help her, and with that he knew that he was to blame for her wretchedness, and that he had done something wrong. "Isn't divorce possible?" he said feebly. She shook her head without answering. "Couldn't you take your son and still leave him?" "Yes, but it all depends on him." "Now I must go to him," she said shortly. Her presentiment that all would again go on in the old way had not deceived her. "On Tuesday I shall be in Petersburg, and everything can be settled." "Yes," she said, "but don't let us talk any more of it." Anna's carriage, which she had sent away in order to come back to the little gate of the Reed Garden, drove up. Anna said goodbye to Vronsky and drove home. Chapter 23. On Monday there was the usual session of the commission of the 2nd of June. Alexey Alexandrovich walked into the hall where the session was held, greeted the members and the president as usual, and sat down in his place, putting his hand on the papers laid ready before him. Among those papers lay the necessary evidence and a rough outline of the speech he intended to make. But he did not really need these documents. He remembered every point and did not think it necessary to go over in his memory what he would say. He knew that when the time came and when he saw his enemy facing him and studiously endeavoring to assume an expression of indifference, his speech would flow of itself better than he could prepare it now. He felt that the import of a speech was of such magnitude that every word of it would have weight. Meantime, as he listened to the usual report, he had the most innocent and inoffensive air. No one, looking at his white hands with their swollen veins and long fingers, so softly stroking the edges of the white paper that lay before him, and at the air of weariness with which his head drooped on one side, would have suspected that in a few minutes a torrent of words would flow from his lips that would arouse a fearful storm, set the members shouting and attacking one another, and force the president to call for order. When the report was over, Alexey Alexandrovich announced in his subdued, delicate voice that he had several points to bring before the meeting in regard to the organization of the native tribes. All attention was turned upon him. Alexey Alexandrovich cleared his throat, and without looking at his opponent, but selecting, as he always did while he was delivering his speeches, the first person sitting opposite him, an inoffensive little old man who never had an opinion of any sort in the commission, began to expound his views. When he reached the point about the basic and organic law, his opponent jumped up and began to protest. Stremov, who was also a member of the commission and was also stunned to the quick, began defending himself, and an altogether stormy session followed. But Alexey Alexandrovich triumphed, and his motion was carried. Three new commissions were appointed, and the next day, in a certain Petersburg circle, nothing else was talked of but this session. Alexey Alexandrovich's success had been even greater than he had anticipated. Next morning, Tuesday, Alexey Alexandrovich, on awakening, recalled with pleasure his triumph of the previous day, and he could not help smiling, though he tried to appear indifferent, when the head clerk, anxious to flatter him, informed him of the rumors that had reached him concerning what had happened in the commission. Absorbed in business with the head clerk, Alexey Alexandrovich had completely forgotten that it was Tuesday, the day fixed by him for the return of Anna Arkadyevna, and he was surprised and received a shock of annoyance when a servant came in to inform him of her arrival. Anna had arrived in Petersburg early in the morning. The carriage had been sent to meet her in accordance with her telegram, and so Alexey Alexandrovich might have known of her arrival. But when she arrived, he did not meet her. She was told that he had not yet gone out, but was busy with the head clerk. She sent word to her husband that she had come, went to her own room, and occupied herself in sorting out her things, expecting he would come to her. But an hour passed. He did not come. She went into the dining room on the pretext of giving some directions and spoke loudly on purpose, expecting him to come out there, but he did not come, though she heard him go to the door of his study as he parted from the head clerk. She knew that he should before long go out of his office as usual, and she wanted to see him before that, so that their attitude to one another might be defined. She walked across the drawing room and went resolutely to him. When she went into his study, he was in official uniform, obviously ready to go out, sitting at a little table on which he rested his elbows, looking dejectedly before him. She saw him before he saw her, and she knew that he was thinking of her. On seeing her, he would have given rise, but changed his mind. Then his face flushed hotly, a thing Anna had never seen before, and he got up quickly and went to meet her, looking not at her eyes, but above them, at her forehead and hair. He went up to her, took her by the hand, and asked her to sit down. "I am very glad you have come," he said, sitting down beside her, and obviously wishing to say something, he stuttered. Several times he attempted to speak, but stopped, in spite of the fact that in preparing herself for meeting him, she had schooled herself to despise and accuse him. She did not know what to say to him, and she felt pity for him, and so the silence lasted rather long. "Is Seriosha quite well?" he said, and without waiting for an answer, he added, "I shan't be dining at home tonight, and I must go out directly." "I had thought of going to Moscow," she said. "No, you did quite right to come," he said, and was silent again. Seeing that he was powerless to begin the conversation, she began herself. "Alexey Alexandrovich," she said, looking at him and without dropping her eyes under his persistent gaze at her hair, "I'm a guilty woman. I'm a bad woman. Yet I am the same as I was, as I told you then, and I have come to tell you that I can change nothing." "I haven't asked you about that," he said all at once, resolutely and with hatred looking her straight in the face. "That was as I had supposed." Under the influence of anger, he apparently regained complete possession of all his faculties. "But as I told you then and have written to you," he said in a thin, shrill voice, "I repeat now that I am not bound to know this. Ignore it. Not all wives are so kind as you to be in such a hurry to communicate such agreeable news to their husbands." He laid special emphasis on the word agreeable. "I shall ignore it so long as the world knows nothing of it, so long as my name is not disgraced. And so I simply inform you that our relations must be just as they have always been, and that only in the event of your compromising yourself, I shall be obliged to take steps to secure my honor." "But our relations cannot be the same as always," Anna began in a timid voice, looking at him with dismay. When she saw once more those composed gestures, heard that shrill, childlike, and sarcastic voice, her aversion for him extinguished her pity for him, and she felt only afraid, but at all costs she wanted to make clear her position. "I cannot be your wife while I," she began. He laughed a cold and malignant laugh. "The manner of life you have chosen is reflected, I suppose, in your ideas. I have so much of both respect and contempt. I respect your past and despise your present. That I was far from the interpretation you put on my words." Anna sighed and bowed her head. "Though indeed I fail to comprehend how, with the independence you show," he went on, getting hot, "announcing your infidelity to your husband and seeing nothing reprehensible in it, apparently you can see anything reprehensible in performing a wife's duty in relation to her husband. Alexey Alexandrovich, what is it you want of me?" "I want never to meet that man here, and I want you to conduct yourself so that neither society nor the servants could possibly reproach you. I want you not to see him. That's not much, I think. And in return, you will enjoy all the privileges of a faithful wife without fulfilling her duties. That's all I have to say to you. Now it's time for me to go. I'm not dining at home." He got up and moved toward the door. Anna got up too, bowing in silence. He let her pass before him. Chapter 24. The night spent by Levin on the haycock did not pass without an effect upon him. The way in which he had been managing his land revolted him and lost all attraction for him. In spite of the magnificent harvest, never had there been, or at least it had never seemed so to him, so many hindrances and so many quarrels between him and the peasants as that year. And the origin of these failures and these hostility was now perfectly comprehensible to him. The delight he had experienced in the work itself and the consequent greater intimacy with the peasants, the envy he felt of them, of their life, the desire to adopt that life, which had been to him that night not a dream but an intention, the execution of which he had thought out in detail. All this had so transformed his view of the farming of the land as he had managed it, that he could not take his former interest in it, and could not help seeing that unpleasant relation between him and the workpeople which was the foundation of it all. The herd of improved cows, such as Pava, the whole land plowed over and enriched, the 9 level fields surrounded with willow fences, the 90 desiatinas heavily manured, drill plows, and all the rest of it. It was all splendid if only the work had been done by himself, or by himself and his comrades, by people in sympathy with him. But he saw clearly now his work on a book of agriculture, in which the chief element in husbandry was to have been the laborer, greatly assisted him in this. That the sort of farming he was carrying on was nothing but a cruel and stubborn struggle between him and the laborers, in which there was, on one side, his side, a continual intense effort to change everything to a pattern he considered better, on the other side, the natural order of things. And in this struggle he saw that with immense expenditure of force on his side, and with no effort or even intention on the other side, the sole attainment was that the work did not go to the liking of either side, and that splendid tools, splendid cattle and land were spoiled with no good to anyone. Worst of all, the energy expended on this work was not merely wasted. He could not help feeling now, since the meaning of his system had become clear to him, that the aim of his energy was a most unworthy one. In reality, what was the struggle about? He was struggling for every groat, and he could not help it, for he had only to relax his efforts, and he would not have had the money to pay his laborers' wages. While they were only struggling to be able to do their work easily and agreeably, that is to say, as they were used to doing it, it was for his interest that every laborer should work as hard as possible, and that while doing so, he should keep his wits about him, so as to try not to break the winnowing machines, the horse race, the threshing machines, that he should attend to what he was doing. What the laborer wanted was to work as pleasantly as possible, with rest, and above all, carelessly and heedlessly, without thinking. That summer, Levin saw this at every step. He sent the men to mow some clover for hay, picking out the worst patches where the clover was overgrown with grass and weeds, and of no use for seed. Again and again they mowed his best desiatinas of seed clover, justifying themselves by the pretext that the bailiff had told them to, and trying to pacify him with the assurance that it would make splendid hay, but he knew that it was because those desiatinas were so much easier to mow. He sent out a hay machine for pitching the hay. It was broken at the first row because it was dull work for a peasant to sit on the seat in front with the great wings waving above him. And he was told, "Don't trouble. Sure, the women folks will pitch it quick enough." The plows were practically useless because it never occurred to the laborer to raise the coulter when he turned the plow. And in forcing it round, he tortured the horse and spoiled the ground, and then begged Levin not to mind it. The horses were allowed to stray into the wheat because not a single laborer wanted to be night watchman, and in spite of orders to the contrary, the laborers insisted on taking turns for night duty about the horses. And when Vanka, after working all day long, fell asleep, he would say, very penitent for his fault, "Do what you will to me." 3 of the best heifers were allowed to overeat themselves to death by letting them into the clover aftermath without care as to drenching them, and nothing would make the men believe that they had been blown out by the clover. But they told Levin, by way of consolation, that one of their neighbors had lost 112 head of cattle in 3 days. All this happened not because anyone felt ill will to Levin or to his farming. On the contrary, he knew that they liked him, thinking him a simple gentleman, their highest praise. But it happened simply because all they wanted was to work merrily and fearlessly, and his interests were not only remote and incomprehensible to them, but fatally opposed to their most just claims. Long before, Levin had felt dissatisfaction with his own position in regard to the land. He saw that his boat leaked, but he did not look for the leak, perhaps purposely deceiving himself. But now he could deceive himself no longer. The farming of the land, as he was managing it, had become not merely unattractive, but revolting to him, and he could take no further interest in it. To this now was joined the presence, only 30 verstas off, of Kitty, Shcherbatskaya, whom he longed to see and could not. Darya Alexandrovna Oblonskaya had invited him, when he was over there, to come with the object of renewing his proposal to her sister, who would, so she gave him to understand, accept it now. Levin himself had felt on seeing Kitty Shcherbatskaya that he had never ceased to love her, but he could not go over to the Oblonskys knowing she was there. The fact that he had proposed to her and that she had refused him had placed an insuperable barrier between her and him. "I can't ask her to be my wife merely because she can't be the wife of the man she wanted to marry," he said to himself. The thought of this made him cold and hostile to her. "I should not be able to speak to her without a feeling of reproach. I could not look at her without resentment, and she will only hate me all the more as she's bound to. And besides, how can I now, after what Darya Alexandrovna told me, go to see them? Can I help showing that I know what she told me? And I shall come to forgive her magnanimously and take pity on her, and go through a performance before her of forgiving and deigning to bestow my love on her. Why did Darya Alexandrovna tell me that? I might have seen her by chance, then everything would have happened of itself. But as it is, it's out of the question. Out of the question." Darya Alexandrovna sent him a letter asking him for a side saddle for Kitty's use. "I'm told you have a side saddle," she wrote to him. "I hope you will bring it over yourself." This was more than he could stand. How could a woman of any intelligence, of any delicacy, put her sister in such a humiliating position? He wrote 10 notes and tore them all up, and then sent a saddle without any reply. To write that he would come was impossible, because he could not come. To write that he could not come because something prevented him, or that he would be away, would be still worse.